Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio War Nerd. The day today is June 8th, 2023, and this is episode 382. I'm Mark, I'm the co-host here, and I am in smoky Western New York, where as of yesterday, we had the worst air, our little Rochester area, in the entire world. And actually, I think my suburb or this suburb, it was the worst among suburbs of this little county here in Monroe County. So I feel pretty darned privileged to be hacking my brains out this morning. I was actually hacking. Anyway, you're listening to Radio War Nerd. Subscribe at patreon.com/Radio War Nerd. And I am on the line, of course, with the War Nerd himself, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecherio in Puglia. John, not smoky there, but I'm sure something else is going on.
Well, I had to think fast to remember what city we're in. It's actually Nardo, because it's been a hard day. We have this great plan that with a modem we can live near the coast and do the show, and it would be wonderful. But the modem doesn't really work as advertised.
You mean like a mobile modem kind of thing?
Yeah, right? Yeah. We've paid tons of money to it and treated it very nicely. But, you know, it reminds me of the fire in that Jack London story, To Build a Fire, where we're always, before the show, we're always like sort of and piling up the sawdust in front of it and praying that it will work. And it does very frequently. Like today, it worked right up till about showtime. And then, of course, it died. Mm. So we zoomed into Nardo trying to find a hotel. And we have a very nice hotel, but it's a former monastery. And they built Rumi back then. So if anybody hears a kind of Rumi effect in my voice.
Yes, that's why. I mean, it'd be great for Gregorian chants, but not for podcasts.
I'll practice before the next show.
It will be great for the Dies Irae.
What's that?
I think that was today.
The Day of Wrath.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Okay. And as folks can hear, and I wanted to, you know, spring this on them, but as you can hear, Radio War Nerd, friend of the show and all-star favorite of this show, Anibale has joined us today to talk about the happy subject of nuclear war.
That's why I mentioned the Dies Irae, you know.
Very
part of the Gregorian, the Day of Wrath. Okay. Yeah. And he's, I think he's perfectly in tune for what
we're going to discuss. Well, yeah, there is, I think, today. Something, at least in the science fiction imagination, which we share with a big chunk of our audience, something rather Catholic about a post-apocalyptic era. It's like, you know, we felt kind of miserable anyway, so let's just do it.
Yeah, you hate this world anyway, so let's get on to the post-apocalyptic
period. Yeah, a canticle for Leibowitz. And you mentioned Anibale, some kind of video game, I think.
It's science fiction franchise. I'm old, as you know. I'm very old, so I'm not very much into what could be called the current science fiction landscape. But there is one science fiction franchise that is very baroque, very strange, very weird and violent, that is called Warhammer 40K. And in Warhammer 40K, there is this universe, this galaxy, in 40,000 years in the future. And everything is war, okay? There is not a single moment where planets are not blown out, people is killed in mass, there is no genocide. Everybody is really xenophobic, really. Xenophobic, not the kind of xenophobia we imagine in the current landscape. Really xenophobic, you know. You don't have
the Lega would be liberals compared to this, I guess.
The Lega they will be hippies, absolutely. Yeah. You know, communists compared to that. And And it's very violent. It is very satirical, but it's also very interesting because it gives you an idea what is in a galaxy where World War One with nukes goes on forever and ever and ever and ever. And by the way, you are involved into fighting against different alien civilization and chaos. And chaos means chaos gods, the entity that comes from parallel dimension. And there is a phrase that I could not take off my mind while preparing this episode that is related to one of the ultimate weapons that exist into the Warhammer 40K world, that are titans, enormous, gigantic robots with nuclear cannons, nuclear guns in as arms and huge legs, and they are mounted by literally by Gothic cathedral. So you are a Gothic cathedral that goes around firing everyone with plasma weapons. And there is a joke running around into the Warhammer 40K community that say everybody is gangster until the cathedral start to move. Okay. Oh.
Mm, that's beautiful.
Which is, I think that it's not very far from the current, that everybody right now thanks to what is, you know, what's happening in Ukraine, and what is the media landscape that we are subjected right now related to military subjects. Everybody seems to become a bit, I don't know if I can pronounce the word correctly, blasé, related to the subject on nuclear warfare. Oh, yes. Don't worry.
There was a worry about that earlier in the war, let's say the first 6-8 months. And it kind of peaked, I think, when Russia had those, you know, big sort of military disasters in the early fall of last year, and they lost Kharkiv area, and they were losing, you know, Kherson. And Putin himself, like, started changing some of his tone and seemed to hint that, well, he said things that basically said, if, you know, if Russia proper is attacked, you know, we will use everything we have to defend ourselves. I mean, he was clearly, you know, as they say, rattling, you know, the nuclear saber, probably in part to try to kind of keep people off balance a little bit as Russia was trying to sort of shore up its defenses. And people seemed to be a bit worried back then, but you're absolutely right. Like, since then, since it didn't happen, since there weren't any nukes set off, it's incredible how blasé, as you said, people have become with the idea. They don't believe in it anymore. They feel like, oh yeah,
no,
well, there were supposedly these red lines and none of them turned out to be red lines. So there really are no red lines. That whole thing, you know, we were all scared about red lines before. What a joke. Anybody who said that was a joke. And then you have people like Timothy Snyder, you know, the Yale professor, saying that if you even show in any way that you're worried about nuclear war, you're essentially a traitor because you're giving in to Putin's blackmail. So we must not even talk about the possibility of it, because that is akin to treason and giving in. It's madness, man. Absolute madness. I'm sorry. One thing I wanted to say, like, it reminds me, there's some principle, and I can't remember it now, some kind of psychological principle, but it's something like, they talked about it in terms of like texting and driving or drinking and driving. Like, you might be really worried about texting and driving or drinking and driving. You think you can get into a crash. And it's rare still that you will get into a crash and kill yourself or kill somebody. So you do it one time, a couple times, and your fear of it happening goes way down when it doesn't happen after your first few times, even though the percentage, you know, even though the danger is still there psychologically when it doesn't happen, you think actually the danger itself is much less than it used to be, when the danger has always been the same. You just got lucky, you know. So yeah.
Well, yes, but well, Baz, it is something that happens quite often with repeating, you know,
yeah,
offenders of some kind of law, like thieves, for instance. They keep repeating the same kind of heist or thievery or stealing something on and on and on and on and on until they get caught, you know, because as long as they, you know, everything is okay, everything is fine, nothing is happened, there is this buildup of feeling like you are immortal. But yes, this is one driver for this. But there is another one, is that I still believe, and we have been discussing these even offline quite often, this subject. I think that people tends really to, you know, to misunderstand nukes and what nukes as a physical object, as something that can create effects on the battlefield, on the atmosphere, on, you know, on Earth, on reality, and nukes as a political weapons. Because, I mean, first thing first, nukes are warheads. Well, I'm talking about warheads. I'm not talking about delivery system, okay? Mm-hmm. Warheads are political weapons. They are not military weapons. They are overwhelmingly controlled in the US, in Russia, everywhere, except possibly for Pakistan, okay, which is probably the lone, you know, the lone exclusion to this rule. They are controlled by politics because they were recognized straight from the beginning as political weapon. A political weapon that are not to be used to win a war, but to be used as a sort of something to throw into the balance of power to make sure you're going to get something with the threatening to win, to use them, and so to create damage, or as a sort of secondary effect, particularly in relation to the threat of the use of tactical nukes. And we are going to discuss a bit about tactical nukes, because tactical nukes is probably the most misunderstood element of this equation, okay?
When we saw nuclear war, and I lived through, I guess, the whole era. I mean, I was born, and by the way, I'm the oldest person here, not not Anibale. In the year I was born, the USSR exploded its first hydrogen bomb at Semipalatinsk, I think it is. And it was a few months after I was born. So I've lived with this my whole life. And we had, my family wasn't particularly concerned about nuclear war, but our neighbors, my friends, were genuinely scared of it, which I found rather odd and attributed to their Presbyterianism, which might have been a mistake. But that I know that having lived an entire lifetime with nuclear weapons, it comes and goes. That's the weirdest thing about it.
Yes.
You know, like you have to be reminded.
You're totally right. You're totally right about this. There are moments where they are all over the news. Everybody's talking about it, and then they go back in the background as some kind of unusable relic of a past era, okay?
Yes.
And but they are still here, okay?
Yes.
And they are still very much important, because in the end, one of the reasons why, not the only one, okay? I'm not claiming it's the only one, but one of the reasons why the war in Ukraine is going this way is because, of course, this is a truism, is because of nuclear weapons, the presence of nuclear weapons. Because in the end, we all know that the tripwire is going to be the moment where we decide, for some reason, we means NATO supporting Ukraine, we decide for any reason, I'm not claiming is anything that's going to happen, but anyone deciding to go deeply into Russia to, mm-hmm. you know, put them away, push them away from the Ukraine border, the possibility of Russia responding with nuclear warheads will become very high. So, mm-hmm. and we don't want to risk them. On the other hand, I claim, and I'm claiming it, it's not anybody claiming it, anybody's opinion is not necessary, Marx or John's opinion. I claim that the way Putin's attack on Ukraine and the way the war was, you know, was conducted in the first few days was very much shaped, at least in part, by the threat that some of the border countries like Poland, all the countries on the border with
Baltics, with Ukraine, Romania, uh-huh.
they will respond independently. And there was very much this possibility outside from any NATO control. And this will create an escalation that will create the possibility for the use of nuclear exchange on the battlefield. And this was very much present.
That's really interesting. So you're saying that they might have gotten involved at a certain point?
Yeah.
Because Rasmussen, the former NATO chief, he was in one of the Baltic countries yesterday or today. And he said by this fall, some countries that are in NATO, he basically seemed to say Poland and some of the Baltics might on their own send troops in to bolster Ukraine.
Of course.
Without NATO, which doesn't make any sense to me. Then what does NATO do? Not back them up if they get mauled?
Oh, well, they were at some point, initially they will say, keep quiet, keep calm. But at least the possibility, okay, Russian, if you are crossing the Dnieper in force, we don't know what Poland will do. Mm. Well, at some point, I strongly believe it was on the table in the very first few days. Okay.
And, well, there's something there's something related to this that I've seen many times, which is, gosh darn it, why did we make Ukraine give up those nuclear weapons? Mm. I mean, about a month ago, there was a headline, Bill Clinton regrets having Ukraine
give
up
nuclear weapons. It was Bush Sr. who did, though, really. It was Bush Sr. who cut that deal.
Exactly.
And America did it for America's sake, not for anything
exactly.
else. But,
exactly. This is nonsense. This is really nonsense. This is not. They knew they had to initially. I know this really well, so this is nonsense. The reason why they told Ukraine to give up their nukes is that initially everybody was worried about the possibility that Ukraine was going to become a failed state and start to sell fissile, not exactly, probably not the you know, the delivery system, not the ICBMs or whatever, but at least the warheads or the fissile material inside the warheads or the technology to developing countries, let's call them this way. And everybody was very much worried about that. And then all of a sudden, you know, the situation changed a bit, I think, around 1995, probably. You were there. You remember better than me. And at some point, it became clear that probably this was not going to happen, but it was too late. And in any case, at the moment, what the American administration wanted to have was to have stability. They were much more confident about the idea they were able to control this the Soviet nuclear stockpile with Yeltsin in power there, rather than having the nuclear stockpile dispersed across countries that were really believing that they were going to become failed states. That's it.
Yep.
It's anything else, it's just a lie. They're just lying.
Now, Anibale, I want to ask you something that I've wondered about, like in print and on the air many times, which is, how necessary is the ICBM to a nuclear blast? That is, Could you say if you're North Korea, well, now they have the ICBMs, I guess, but could
Thanks to Ukraine, by the way, that came out in the New York Times. Remember, it was Ukraine that sold them intercontinental ballistic missile technology. So
yeah, but could you, for example, weld a warhead into a chamber in a container ship that was going to enter, say,
yes,
San Diego?
Yes, you can.
And you could detonate it?
Yes, you can. Absolutely, you can. And Joseph Schilling was, he died a few years ago, very old, was one of the, you know, most important nuclear strategists America ever had, particularly during the McNamara era. Wondered in one of his last interviews about this. I mean, if I had been like North Korea or any, you know, terror organization, I would probably try to do whatever I can to achieve the real nuclear capability, not dirty bombs. I mean, bombs that really detonate,
explode,
they explode using uncontrolled chain reaction or thermonuclear technology, and then put them into, you know, a barge or anything that I can put into a port anywhere in the world, and just say, okay, if you don't do what I want, one of your cities, I don't tell you, of course, which one, is going to, you know, be vaporized, and then see, you know, enjoy the panic, just enjoying the people, just making this. Why did, and the reason why this did not happen is very interesting, is crucial about this. It did not happen because secrecy related to nuclear technology, particularly toward thermonuclear technology, and I will tell you why. I mean, we're going briefly to discuss the difference.
Let me just interrupt for a moment for a question. Thermo means roughly H bombs rather than Hiroshima style.
It's fusion, using of fusion instead of fission, and the main difference is that you can. Well, in order to trigger a nuclear explosion, you need fissile material. Fissile material is any kind of material, of substances, that can achieve uncontrolled chain reaction. And if you mine uranium from Australia, South Africa, Kazakhstan, or any places in the world where uranium is available, this uranium that is called uranium-238 is not fissile, okay? It cannot explode. You cannot make bomb as it is. You cannot make bombs out of them. It's very toxic, particularly if you inhale it, but it's not even particularly radioactive. You can, because it's just, most of the radiation is called alpha radiation, and this is a radiation that can be stopped by your skin or a piece of paper. A piece of paper will stop it.
So it's like a more stable version of uranium? Or?
It is stable because it has some, if I remember well, 35,000 years of half-life before it spontaneously changes in anything else. But it's not very radioactive as it is. In order to use it to create an atomic bomb, you need to refine it. In order to refine it, there is unfamiliar with three, but there are at least seven different industrial methods. Take the ore that you are mining it into something that becomes what is called military grade. This is one way. Another way, and so you get uranium that is fissile, can explode, and then you create the atomic bomb and or the nuclear bomb. And then we are going briefly to discuss the two different main designs. Otherwise, the other way you may go is plutonium. And plutonium is uranium that is put into a nuclear pile, and is bombarded with neutrons, and these achieve the dreams of alchemists, transmutation mm-hmm. of matter.
Right.
Magically, this is not magical, this is just physics, uranium 238 becomes plutonium 239. And plutonium 239 need then to be, you know, there is a not complex process, but you can achieve an explosion with much less material. To give you an example, I'm just simplifying, and I'm sorry if any physicist is listening to this, they're probably getting crazy about the sloppy terminology I'm using, but I'm just trying.
No, you're making it understandable to the layman, exactly. Such as us.
Yeah, okay. And the thing is, I will give you a practical example of this. The Hiroshima bomb was a design that required something around 50 kilograms of uranium. That was basically, the design was very simple. There was one ring, a donut-shaped ring of uranium, pure military-grade uranium in one side, and one cylinder of uranium in the other. And through the use of explosive with a very precise timing, and the very precise means to be precise at the millisecond, the donut was shot across the cylinder. Not the other way around, as you see sometime in Wikipedia or other sources. And when the critical, it's called the critical mass, when the total of pure uranium, this is called the pure uranium, is called uranium 235, is together, chain reaction happens and the whole thing blows, okay, and explodes. But you need 50 kilograms of pure ore that takes forever to create. On the other hand, you can achieve, and this was done in Nagasaki, you can achieve a much more powerful explosion using less plutonium, but is shaped in the Nagasaki bomb was based not into two parts being shot one across the other, but into a ball of material that was compressed using explosive and using mirrors, metal mirrors, to reflect the neutrons that were created by the explosion. So increasing the number of neutrons that were, you know, bombarding the material, creating the chain reaction.
Okay, so now I have a layperson's question, which is, well, first of all, that's very interesting. I didn't know that there was an important difference in the design of the two explosions in Japan in 1945. But the other one is, all I've seen about damage is that Hiroshima was overwhelmingly the more destructive bomb. And they usually attribute that to topography, like it was a flat city, right?
Correct.
So, okay.
Correct. This is correct. The point is easy to check these if you ever been in Japan or, you know, even just looking at the Google Maps. Nagasaki is a beautiful, by the way, beautiful city that is sitting into a very hilly area. Mm-hmm. And both explosion were airburst. Mm-hmm. The bombs were made to explode well high above the ground. And I'll tell you why. And this is a crucial element, particularly for any future assessment of the use of smaller tactical nukes. But the difference, because the point is, you don't do it, you know, by chance. You want to have the explosion high over soft targets. Soft targets mean targets with a lot of people, because you want to maximize the damage to people and the damage to soft targets like wooden houses, like most of the houses that there were in Japan, in Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. But the main difference was that the presence of substantial hills protected part of Nagasaki from the blast, from mainly in part from the radiation, but this is, I mean, a subject that we need to discuss.
There's the blast wave. There's the heat of the blast when that big ball of fire goes up, and then there's the radiation.
The fireball. And the thermal radiation and and the overpressure, the PSI, the air blast overpressure, that, you know, they are the main cause for damage in any nuclear explosion, except for very specific design, warhead design.
The neutron bomb leaves the cities intact, kills the people. Yeah, I remember that one.
Which was never built, by the way, because the W-70 warhead that was, you know, mentioned as, you know, hugely promoted as a neutron bomb, was not a neutron bomb because it was something in the 100 kilotons or even 400 kilotons range. So they will, I mean, destroy cities and kill people. And the most of the people will be killed by the explosion, not by the neutrons, which will deny the idea behind the neutron bomb. We're going to discuss this briefly. Because
the neutron bomb always sounded like some kind of real estate developer, you know, it's like a real estate developer and a, you know, and a contractor going to a bar and come up with it, you know.
Well, you'll be surprised of the reason why it was built. It was built because his name, I know his second name, apologies, sometimes I forget about names. I know his second name was Cohen.
Samuel T. Cohen, I think, yeah.
Okay. Samuel, yeah, that's it. And he really was concerned about the idea about all these tanks coming in from the Fulda Gap or whatever, and doing Bagration operation, you know, stuff on central Germany. And because, of course, you had to stop them somehow. He said, if we are going to use nukes, and we know we are going to use nukes, if you use large, you know, 100 kilotons or megaton range nukes, we're going to kill the tanks, but also kill a lot of innocent people. If we can have very small, focused warheads that creates small, very little damage in terms of particular hair blast, very little hair blast, very little thermal damage, but a lot of fast neutrons. And neutrons are the worst in terms of ionizing radiation. They're worse than gamma rays, they're worse than anything, because they're very difficult to shield.
Yeah, I remember that about neutrons. It was one of those poetic bits of physics that I kind of liked, even though I could never have done the math, which was neutrons pass through us, they pass through the planets, they pass through everything, you know, like plankton through a salmon net or something.
No, but these are, I think that these are neutrinos. Neutrinos is something.
Whoops.
Neutrinos.
They ain't the same thing?
No, they are. There are not. Neutrinos are fascinating particles because they are, even now, we are all being, you know, passed through by trillions of neutrinos, but they hardly interact with any of our matter because they are small, that their mass is minimal. Neutrons have a much larger mass, and so they interact with matter much more. Keep in mind one thing. If there is a supernova, if the sun will be big enough to explode like a supernova, it will emit enough neutrinos to kill you instantly, even if right now there are trillions of neutrinos that are passing through our bodies. So there are, you know, it all depends how much stuff.
So volume of neutrinos is the big issue.
Exactly. Yeah, okay. Neutrons, on the other hand, neutrons are, you know, the one of the constituent of the nuclear atom. Atom is made by protons, which are positively charge, and neutrons, which are neutrally charged. And then there is a cloud of electrons, we are negatively charged with wits around. And people sometimes, they don't visualize how empty an atom is. Because if in order to have an idea how empty any atom is, you just have to imagine if you could blow an atom of hydrogen, for instance, to the scale of a large baseball stadium, the nucleus will be a small plate, you know, the kind of plate they use in a kitchen at the center of the stadium. And the lonely electron, you know, buzzing around, orbiting around the nucleus will be even smaller. Everything else is empty. Okay?
Wow.
Everything. So we are mostly made by nothing. Most of the matter that makes our bodies just nothing. It's emptiness.
Empty space.
Okay.
Wow.
Yeah. It's empty space. So, but the force that keeps the nucleus together, nucleus is made by positively charged protons that are held together by something that's called a strong nuclear force, and neutrons. If you, this force keeping the nucleus together is the one that is exploited in nuclear weapons. Because if you take a large uranium has a lot of protons and neutrons, and if you, and it's very unstable. So if you can find a way bombarding it with other neutrons to separate, the energy released is the energy that is used into the explosion. On the other hand, at the other end of the spectrum, if you take two atoms of hydrogen, that is very small. The hydrogen atoms are very, very small because normally they are one proton right. and one or more, or no, or one or more neutrons. If you can have enough energy to make them go together, and so the strong nuclear force keep them together, it will release the sum of the two atoms that are glued together is less than the total energy. So a lot of energy is released. And this is a thermonuclear weapon. So fission weapon, atomic weapon, the one used in Nagasaki, Hiroshima, you split the atom. Castle Bravo, thermonuclear weapons, the 20 megaton Tsar bomb, the 20 megatons horror that you know you have seen in countless news feed, they are fusion weapons. You fuse together two atoms of very light matter.
Another fun nuclear age trivia that I grew up with, is it true that Castle Bravo and Tsar Bomba were so powerful that they might have cracked the Earth's surface and that was why they were dropped?
No. Okay, this is a myth. But there are two interesting facts that can be related to it. The first is related to the Tsar Bomba. The Tsar Bomba was a nominally 50 megaton monster that was just made to show off, to demonstrate that you could create a multi-stage thermonuclear weapon to, you know, any kind of yield.
This one goes to 11.
Yeah, exactly. That was made like this. And initially, the first design was not for 50 megatons, but was for 100 megatons. Okay. Mm-hmm. And at some point, the Russian scientists and even the Russian leadership, they decided, what the hell is going on here? Because the point is, in order to achieve the 100 megaton yield, you need to have a third stage. A fusion weapon works very roughly like this. You have an atomic bomb, one with uranium or plutonium that explode, and these create enough energy to squeeze the atoms of a secondary stage made of hydrogen together, creating a fusion. I told you, difference. Fission, you separate the atom, you split the atom.
Fusion, smash them together.
You smash them together.
Yeah.
Okay, the first stage separate the atoms. The second stage compress the atoms and generate enough energy, enough X-rays, neutron even, that you can activate a casing around made by, no, it could be made by lead. It's called a tamper. The technical term is a tamper that is made either of lead or could be made by spent uranium that achieves something goes fast fission. That is fission that goes not to 11, but to 12 or 13 or 14 or whatever you want. This, while the first two stages, so fission, fusion, are really, if they are designed properly, they are clean. The third one is really dirty. It creates a fallout, a dispersal of radioactive material that is insane. So if they had really used the initial 100 megatons design, it would have doubled the fallout, the global fallout in 1961 globally. Okay, because of the prevailing winds have carried out dispersed fissionable material everywhere in the world. And I mean, they decided not. So no, that's not the case. I mean, if 50 megatons is enough. The problem with Castle Bravo is the first thing is that it was supposed to be a 5 megaton explosion. It turned out to be, because of a mistake in calculation, 15 megatons. Okay.
Oops,
because
oops.
Exactly. It was really whoops.
Somebody else who couldn't pass algebra.
Exactly. Because the material they used in the secondary stage, they didn't understand that it was going to create much more energy than it was supposed to. But the idea was at some point in the design stage of thermonuclear weapons, and even to some extent at the design stage of regular atomic weapon, someone started to say, okay, what if we detonate this, the global Earth atmosphere will ignite?
Yeah, right.
And okay.
Does that mean because the chain reaction would basically catch on in the atmosphere?
Yes, exactly. Right. Because the idea
something
was
like Ice Nine, only with air.
Exactly, exactly. And much faster.
Yeah.
Because it would last, I mean, it would probably go around the world very, very quickly.
And right.
It's mentioning again Warhammer 40K. It's something that happens in Warhammer 40K at most every week. And it's called Exterminatus.
Wow.
And
wow.
It's done in planets who don't comply.
I remember at one of those early moments, like in the late 40s, I think a lot of humorous would joke in a nervous way about, you know, well, they're testing something and the atmosphere may ignite and it may not ignite.
Yes.
But, you know, I certainly hope it won't.
Oh, yes. It's very controversial because this last stage, it was repeated again and again and again. It, some people thought it was intended as a joke. Some people takes it a bit more seriously. But, you know, I mean, at least the story about the Russian Soviet leadership being worried about global fallout doubling overnight with the Tsar bomb. But this is really true. Okay, this has been confirmed. So it's, but that was the era where, you know, everybody was hell-bent on creating huge weapons. And then at a certain point, and it was probably one of the biggest changes in the way nuclear weapons were perceived, the Castle Bravo made an enormous impression on the general public, okay? Because not much because of the idea that, I mean, it was supposed to be 5 megatons, it became 15. Or even because a lot of the scientists and the technicians that were there on Eniwetok, on the Eniwetok Atoll, they were actually trapped inside the bunkers by nuclear fire, the fallout, everything, you know, radiation and everything. But because of the story, you might have heard it, the plume of the fallout went into it, Japanese trawler, fishing trawler that was nearby, the Lucky Dragon 5. They were all heavily irradiated, and one of the fishermen died, okay, because of the intense fallout. And this made, of course, you know, Japanese were not happy with it, let's say. It becomes starting to be a bit too intense. And there was the start of everything you feel, the pop culture idea about thermonukes. Godzilla on the beach, mutants roaming the desert in a post-nuclear society. Everything starts with that. Okay. And because before Castle Bravo, the idea was nuclear bombs were huge. They were killers. They were everything. But yes, it's something manageable. The idea of the end of the world, the apocalyptic perception of the nuclear warfare starts in 1954 with Castle Bravo. Okay. It is something that, and it is the moment where everybody start to think, well, what should we do with those things? Okay. And remember that this is the moment where Eisenhower, who has the distinction of being probably the only US president who was not extremely hostile to nukes. He saw them as a sort of opportunity, while almost everybody else, maybe, except for Truman, saw them as a liability or as something they had to...
You mean that Eisenhower was basically more willing to see them as an actual military weapon than other presidents?
Eisenhower, at some point, you know that Eisenhower was very budget conscious. Okay, yeah. Very much. Yes. More than Truman, definitely, but yes. Definitely even more than Kennedy. He was to say, okay, we're going to spend, and he was also worried about.
So a cheap solution to defense.
Yeah, exactly. He said, look, we have these things, and with these things, it's likely we don't want to have a global confrontation with USSR. And so why don't we, instead of, you know, spending a lot of money building a sophisticated conventional weapon system, why don't we point about them? Maybe they could be an opportunity.
And that was always the question that I wondered about as an American. Like, we often describe our forces in Central Europe as a tripwire, and the tripwire was attached to a nuclear weapon, really. Like,
correct.
If you cross this line, if you cross the Fulda Gap, the nukes will go off. And I always wondered, like, okay, if you're going to take that seriously, why not just have one person with a swagger stick in the Fulda Gap, and then... If you make me drop this swagger stick, okay, there, you made me drop it. Now the nukes.
This was precisely what Eisenhower wanted to have. Eisenhower was not really happy about the idea to have a large force stationed in Europe. He say, also, he was not really happy to work as, of course, I mean, he had made this experience during World War II, so you can understand the way he felt about it, but... He was not really happy about the idea to have be, okay, we have to have this kind of umbrella covering all Europe and protecting everybody. Because, of course, Eisenhower had a lot of headaches, particularly with the French, you know, but also with the UK. He didn't really have this very happy relationship with them. And again, my own impression reading I've been reading in my life a lot of what Eisenhower wrote. And it seems like his experience as a commander in the European theater in the 40s made him very wary about the ideas a multi-role force could work, because he knew a lot of his allies were difficult people to deal with, particularly the French. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then we all know, you know, the Suez crisis happened, and at some point he really had to, you know, pound the fist on the table and say, stop it. Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't want to hear any of this nonsense again. So these, and also on the other hand, he was really wary about the idea of being hijacked, or seeing, you know, his budget hijacked by what he called the industrial military complex.
Which certainly happened, and probably couldn't be stopped. Still can't be stopped.
He didn't like conventional wars and large conventional militaries. He preferred CIA covert operations and the nukes.
Yeah. Look, the idea is this. We want to win. We want to have complete control over our of influence. If you seriously try to enter inside this, you know, this our scope of power, as I call it, we're going to use nukes, but before that, we're going to do a lot of dirty tricks, a lot of covert operation and stuff like that to make sure you behave properly. What is the problem with this approach? It makes sense. It makes a lot of sense. The problem is that when the first thing is that it relied on Soviet Union not rushing into a sort of mechanism of trying to improve, technologically improve his forces and putting a lot of money into his armed forces to improve the technology of that and be more flexible and more effective, particularly on what is 60% of the budget of a nuclear weapon system, which is delivery. Remember, building warheads is relatively cheap. Is the delivery that costs a lot. Is 60% of the cost of the entire system is just delivery. Just building the airplanes, building the submarines, building the missiles, building the warheads itself is not that expensive. And so the point is, when you could have, Eisenhower say, well, you could have, for instance, an air force, and we can use the air force we already have, or even few odd stuff like the Valkyrie, and we already discussed this on another. We can penetrate the Soviet airspace and make sure they know that we are going to have a list of target, the so-called SIOP, the Strategic Integrated Operational Plan, which is still affected and is been. I think it's been updated every few years, and is basically the list of targets of the U.S. Nuclear strategy. That if this happens, we're going to eat this and this and this and this and this. And it's the first time they started to have this was around the Kennedy era. But before that, they just decided to say, okay, we have enough yield to assure that we are going to obliterate the enemy, and they know it, okay? And so it's going mutual assured destruction, and we are going to be, everybody's going to behave, okay? What happened is that when Kennedy, if you remember that, we already mentioned that in the Valkyrie episode, but Kennedy campaigned over the missile gap. And then when he entered office, he was told, there is no missile gap. It's a ruse. And he discovered that the idea he and in part McNamara, but most of the Kennedy stuff had was this, okay, we have this huge lumbering heavy, nuclear heavy force that is very inflexible. So if anything happens, it's either covert operation or nukes. There's mm-hmm. nothing in between. And so they decided to try to move, of course, in part for military political reason, in part because, of course, there was pressure from the industry. This is to say, okay, if you're just going to buy few models of airplanes, few models of ICBMs and nukes, you know, there's no money for us to, well, you know the deal.
Yeah. On the other hand, if there was nothing but, you know, nukes and dirty tricks people, you probably wouldn't have had 500,000 troops in Vietnam, which didn't work out very well.
Exactly. Yeah. That you said it beautifully, mm-hmm. John, beautifully. That's it. Because the point is, why do you want to have a flexible force? Because you want to project power.
Yeah.
If you want to project power, you just will start to do funny things in places like Vietnam. And remember the story how America got stuck in Vietnam because of, in my opinion, and I know maybe there is people listening to these Warners and Warnerettes who are completely disagreeing with it, but I strongly believe, for me, it's an article of faith, that one of the reasons why there was a Vietnam the way it was because people misread Cuba. Mm. Because your leadership at some point started really to feel, oh, this is what Matt McNamara said. Okay, he said, this was the best managed international crisis ever, mm-hmm. which is partly true. But the point is, it did work because on the other side, they had Khrushchev, because there was the whole thing of the intermediate range, the Jupiter missile staying close to where you are right now, John, in Puglia mm-hmm. and in Turkey. There was all this stuff that made a lot of luck, by the way. Mm-hmm. But also, there was, and this was not appreciated at the time, they started to appreciate it 10 years later, there was the way the Russian armed forces and the Russian nuclear forces were designed, which did a lot to make sure the Cuba crisis didn't go the way it could have. Okay, yeah. It was not just because Camelot, you know the whole thing, Camelot.
Yeah. But yeah, and, but I think there was a lot of, I don't know what to call it, war inertia in the United States system after the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was like someone who's both eager for a fight and very afraid of the fight, seeing the fight called off at the last minute. You got to get that energy out somewhere.
And yes.
They needed to do it. They couldn't do it in Cuba because there was an explicit agreement that was sort of signed with a nuclear pen, as it were, that we weren't going to go to war over Cuba. But if we weren't going to go to war over Cuba, how do we know we're not a wimp?
And there is another element, which is, again, I don't think it's appreciated enough except for, you know, the kind of stuff you read into specialistic paper, is that there was a huge difference in 1962 between USSR and America. USSR had a civil protection, extensive yes. civil protection network.
Yeah, those elevators in the Moscow metro
yeah.
that
yeah.
go down 300 meters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The largest in the world. You didn't yeah. had one because at some point you
we hid under our desks, I think.
yeah, that'll take care of it.
Yeah.
No, or buying private private shelters and so it's one point the US leadership did really feel when the Cuba crisis was over was first, well, thank God there was no nuclear confrontation, because we could not fight that. And whatever kind of nuclear strategy we have in the US is not worth fighting. And on the other hand, in the USSR, the strategy was worth fighting. Again, this was the other big difference between the two ways of seeing nukes.
Yeah. Another sort of outsider question. I don't know much about this, but I know the name Herman Kahn, and he was supposedly thinking the unthinkable, like
Hudson Institute.
Yeah. So what did he have to say about that?
Okay. Herman Kahn is, I love him. I love him. I have his book on thermonuclear war on, you know, sitting somewhere near my desk almost nonstop. It's unreadable. It's completely unreadable, but it's beautiful.
Isn't he Dr. Strangelove, or one of the models for Dr. Strangelove?
No, that was Teller, wasn't it?
No. He was the whole story goes like this. Both Kahn and Schelling advised Kubrick, because the story is that Kubrick asked for Strangelove, this story that was taken by Peter George book.
Right.
And Peter George book is very grim, very dark,
safe,
very grim,
right?
Very fail. No, yeah. Failsafe is another one. It's called Red Alert. It's called Red Alert. And it's very dark, very grim. And this is the story, I mean, you see more or less in the film. But the point is, as Kubrick say, okay, the way the war starts, it seems to be unlikely. So he asked Schelling, and then had exchanges with Kahn, say, can I create a realistic scenario for the start of thermonuclear war? And the point is, Schelling later say, we could not find any. Why do you start a thermonuclear war? The whole thing doesn't make sense. So they started to create this whole scenario that it was possible, but very unlikely, of senior General Ripper getting mad. And the thing is, of course, Kubrick read on thermonuclear war, and he did really like the language, because the language is beautiful. As a book, it's unreadable, but if you take bits of it, it's marvelous. It's absolutely marvelous. It's like is thermonuclear porn. Okay, I just call it this
new
way.
New podcast, and thermonuclear porn.
And everything, and the point is, he did like the whole story. Herman Kahn was totally against mutually assured destruction. He thought it was absurd. Okay. So he created, as a absurd scenario, the idea of the doomsday device.
Right.
Okay. The idea of the machine that is controlled by computer that will start to explode all these warheads in a specific scenario. But it was not a proposal. It was something like, look, where are we going if we pursue this thing of mutual assured destruction, a fail-safe device. You know, there are ideas which are, in my opinion, half fantasies, half not, about the dead man and device
dead man switch,
by the
or whatever
Soviet.
They call it. Yeah, yeah.
Dead man switch. Yeah. But the point is, it was definitely designed by both sides thought about this. But it was never made for obvious reason. And Kubrick went to Kahn and it basically stole the whole stuff. And Kahn went to Kubrick and say, well, you were maybe supposed to credit me, you know. And Kubrick say, oh, Hollywood doesn't work that way, you know. Okay.
Oh, my
and so,
God.
So, no, Teller was, no, Teller was different. Teller was.
I guess Teller is the villain in a lot of Philip K. Dick novels, and I think
he also physically was more the model for Peter Sellers' character. But can I just interrupt real quick? Because I want to return, just to get us back to it and then go forward again. The initial frame of what we're talking about here is all just, I mean, every single bit of this is fascinating, and you know, I'm learning stuff always as I do from you, Anibale. But the framing of this again was the Ukraine war, the threat of Russia using nukes. What kind of nukes might Russia use if it were to use nukes, or is there no way Russia would use nukes? And kind of subsidiary to that, just I'll throw it out there now, and then we can get back to it, is this idea, because even among people that I've heard who've said it is, even though it's very unlikely, which I agree, it's very unlikely at this point, certainly, that Putin would order nukes to be used, and it would be Putin ordering it or not ordering it.
It will be Putin. It will
be Putin. Yes, of course, 100%. As you said, it's a political decision. Nevertheless, if he did try and use, he would most likely use a so-called demonstrative tactical nuke. And then the idea is, and I've heard a lot of serious people say this, and once he does, he's going to find out it doesn't change, like it doesn't achieve anything, number one. Number two, all the world, he loses all of his allies. And everybody is, this is 100% baked in assumption by everybody in the West. So all his allies, i.e., you know, primarily China, India, and like major African countries, all abandon him. And number three, the threat is gone. The actual use of the nuclear weapon is like the emperor's clothes sort of thing. Like it's no longer useful. To me, that doesn't make a lot of sense.
It doesn't.
Okay, thank you. Because it just seems like wishful thinking ad absurdum. Like imagine every, you know, possible most optimistic outcome and assume that that is the grimmest outcome that your mind can come up with, you know. But anyway,
okay,
yeah,
no you're right, is wishful thinking. Okay, yeah. I think we need to, in order to understand what are the Russian options right now, a very 1 minute primer over the effect, main effect of current nuclear war. Nuclear war right now, they are being downscaled a lot in respect to, you know, those monsters that Tsar bomb and everything. We are well below, normally, we're well below the megaton range because we are not going to use one big bomb, but many smaller, because the damage inflicted, this can be demonstrated with easy physics and mathematics. The damage you can inflict with many smaller bombs is much larger than a single one. Okay.
In terms of total destruction, are you talking about radiation as well, or just the whole package?
Okay. Now, we're precisely coming to this.
Okay.
Because the point is there are two main ways you can use a nuclear weapon is ground burst or air burst. So you have the nuclear weapon detonated high up over your target in order to maximize the fireball, so the heat and the pressure from the air blast. Mm-hmm. Or you can use it with a ground burst in order to maximize the local destruction and the amount of direct radiation that is emitted by the fireball. The tactical weapons are overwhelmingly used as ground burst. Why? Because they are used normally against hard military target, which are designed to withstand large pressure from air blast, you know, it's called a PSI pressure. I never remember, but it's the pressure of the air being moved by the explosion. And this can be incredibly destructive. But now, for instance, a silo for ICBM, you still have two in the US that's still kept there basically for showing. Which can withstand, I think, 6,000 PSI, which is insane, completely insane. So in order to, if you need to hit a bunker or hit anything that is hard, concrete, you need to have a ground burst. What is the problem? The ground burst will generate fallout. The air burst done properly, the way it does, will kill a lot more people in a larger area, but will not create fallout. So
why will the ground burst generate fallout?
because the ground burst raised terrain mixed with the byproduct of the explosion up into the stratosphere.
Right, or organic stuff that's been radiated. Right, okay, yeah.
Exactly. But the point, remember that it works like this. I think I have to debunk a couple of myths related to fallout. The first thing is that fallout doesn't make things radioactive. Fallout is radioactive, but doesn't make things, it falls on radioactive. If powder from, but it works like this, the explosion up into the ground, it creates a crater and burns stuff around, like forest, the kind of things you're experiencing right now, it could happen because of an explosion of a very densely forest area. And the fire will mix with byproduct of the explosion and stuff that have been heavily irradiated by the neutron produced by the explosion and the gamma rays produced by X-rays and everything that the radiation, the ionizing radiation that is produced by the explosion. And this will generate all this ground, loose ground and soot and everything will go into the air and then will fall down because of the rain. These will be radioactive for a while.
All these particles, microparticles. It's sort of like what they talk about when they say that you know the air is unhealthy. It's particles, microparticles that you breathe in or...
Most of these particles will stay, those who are contaminated with iodine 131 will stay radioactive for just 8 days. And after 8 days, they will be okay. But a lot of the stuff will be cesium 132 and strontium 30, which are strontium in particular is very, very, very dangerous because if you inhale it or if you eat it for some way because it ends up in anything that you put into your mouth, like food and anything, it will definitely deposit into your bones. And this will create problem, particularly for children, okay? Most of this stuff, however, is something that will fall in wherever you are. If you stay inside, if you don't go outside for a while, you will be okay. But anything else, like water, food, and the ground will be contaminated by it to a certain extent. It's not going to... The effect of radiation are linear. So if you... it's much worse to get heavily irradiated in a very short time than to get a lot of small radiation over a longer time. We don't understand really well the effect of radiation over a longer time. It's very controversial. But we know that heavy irradiation by gamma rays and anything like that on a very short time is deadly. But this happens if you are close to the fireball. But the point is, all this ground is going to be dispersed. And now, let's go into the Ukraine situation. If Putin decide to send a tactical nuke over, let's say, anywhere east of Kyiv, the plume, because of the prevailing winds, will always go toward Russia.
Right.
So he will have to deal with heavy fallout into, Ukraine, of course, eastern Ukraine, but also western Russia.
So as to remind people that this possibility, although probably unrealistic, is being seriously talked about, I'll just mention that there's an article in the current Telegraph from the UK by someone who, believe it or not, is named Hamish de Breton Gordon. And the headline here is, "We are now dangerously close to nuclear war." But what's really telling about this article is it's only a few paragraphs, and even so, it can't manage to generate any realistic prospect that this might actually happen. In fact, I'll just read a bit of it to say, the Russian special military operation is now in its death throes. which is probably not true, with a rampant, confident, and well-trained and equipped Ukrainian army on the march, which is also probably not true. It is becoming clearer that the Russian military will hit a speed bump conventionally, and with a leader and army commanders with no morals or scruples, we must brace ourselves for further unconventional violence. The attack, blah, blah, blah. Whatever it takes, we must ensure Ukraine prevails as quickly as possible, or as there is still the specter of escalation to chemical, biological, and nuclear war.
Which is interesting, considering that personally, I think that biological weapons are as bad as nuclear weapons. Yeah. So it's I fail to see how nukes can be more terrifying than anthrax. I don't know.
That's the thing. He wants to raise that old specter of nuclear war, but it can't be done with any detail. So the article itself is very vague.
The idea is Putin decided to use tactical nukes on a military target. He creates fallout. Mm-hmm. And unless he decides to use overwhelmingly tactical nukes to invade Ukraine and go all the way to the Polish border, which will create a World War III, just to be completely straightforward with you, I don't see the point. Second option, he decided to go for an airburst. Okay, he could decide to go on an airburst over, Kyiv, for instance, to kill a lot of people. I don't see the point at the moment. It would make no sense. Let's suppose he decided to do something else, like a
show
of
force.
What
about an airburst? Yeah, exactly. A demonstrative, as they said, like over Snake Island or something,
Well, he could decide to do something like an airburst with a very high airburst using what is called an EMP, electromagnetic pulse.
Right.
That his effect is destroying all the technological electric infrastructure on the ground without creating any particular problem. There is a bit of irradiation, but if you are doing properly, is something that you will minimize the effect, the damage on people. But it will be absolutely devastating over any kind of internet transmission infrastructure. Anything that is not shielded is going to, burn, to fry, literally. Okay, again.
Wait, you mean all electronics, like literally fry?
Yeah.
Or you mean like electric lines fry? How do the people not fry?
Anything. It's something like you send a very strong electromagnetic pulse. It's irradiation doing on the certain wavelengths. A lot of electrons also that is are sent very, very fast toward the grounds. And these are captured by anything that is conductive. Like wires, your computer, anything that transmits is
pacemakers.
Going to be overlooked. Is going to anything that transmits current that is not shielded. Radios. Anything they are going
so
to
so all communications go down. All I mean, the
it's
military
everything,
can't function.
Everything
that's a
powerful
weapon.
You don't shield. Anything that you and shielding means having something that may be, for instance, buried underground. But anything that is exposed, it will burn. So it's going to be a disaster. It's not anything that is not shielded, and EMP is very much part of any sensible nuclear strategy because if you remember all those movies where the world ends because someone mistake a flight of pigeons for a launch of ICBMs, actually it doesn't work that way. The way a nuclear attack would be a large scale, the one that all bets off. Okay, I'm going to use everything I have. Is that first you're going to use missiles, a submarine launched ballistic missiles from very close to the coast of your target. And most, at least the very first of those will be EMPs. They will be used to make sure your radars and your communication infrastructure is gone. And then I will try to, using the submarines, I will try to decapitate your leadership, or at very least to eat and destroy what are the most essential communication and command and control nodes of your country. And only then you will have the ICBM being launched by ground, underground silos, or train, or mobile platforms, or anything right. like that. So it's not something where everything is launched at the same time. You know, there are waves of it. And so EMPs, we know very well what they do. But let's suppose, I mean, Putin decided to use a 200 kiloton weapon engineer to create that. He destroy the Kiev infrastructure, yes, which can be rebuilt, by the way. And then what? What? Mm-hmm. Of course, this doesn't mean everybody say, oh, it's not a problem. Oh, mm-hmm. you see, nobody was killed. It means that, okay, it's the start of a nuclear escalation, a real one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, the moment where...
Especially because, you know, sorry, but Ukraine, to be realistic about it, is not the center of power on its particular side in this war. The centers of power are to the west of Ukraine, and they extend across Europe and then across the Atlantic to the U.S.
Yep.
Exactly. What happens if any kind of show of force like this is done? And I'm not saying it could not be done. Maybe it will happen tomorrow. I don't know. I mean, I'm not in a friendly relationship with anybody in Putin's entourage. So I don't know, actually.
I know. We've learned our lesson about Ukraine predictions.
Yes, graveyard of predictions.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think at the moment what Putin wants to do is something else, and in particular what the West and to a lesser extent Ukraine want to do is something else. The West and Ukraine, they really want, we are pursuing the thing that an attrition rate at some point will create a discontent inside the Russian population. This is the strategy. We the mythical revolt by the Russian youth. Okay, the idea that they are going to start to, people start to be discontented, that the power base of Putin will be if the war is going too long. On the other hand, Putin is really pointing at trying to make sure this low level of attrition go on without him losing, you know, having a monumental defeat. He wants to do Finland again, in my view. Okay, but
he wants to drag it out long and outlast the West. But
yeah,
but
we have a bigger population. We have more stuff. We have more money.
Okay, and we are going at some point. People said we'll start to. He knows that not everybody in the West is particularly happy with this war.
Yeah.
So he's trying. I think both strategy at the moment, the more likely strategy are those. But going back to nukes, the point is, the moment anybody is going to do any kind of show of force, the next thing that happens, they're going to have Ohio nuclear launching platforms, submarines, close to the Russian coast in the Arctic Sea and in the Pacific, okay? Very close. And the situation will become incredibly dangerous.
Yes. Yes.
And we're going to go into Cuba 2 again. And Cuba 2 again, at this point, is going to become dangerous because Putin knows that, and everybody
and
knows.
And I would add to that, too. You tell me, but, you know, the air defense systems, they're all being tested against missiles, and they're definitely doing better than they did 30 years ago. And I mean, they, you know, there's a lot of bullshit going around about knocking out, you know, 40 out of 30 missiles and so on, but they're clearly knocking down stuff. And, you know, and the Russians are testing every different way. And obviously the Russians got at one of the Patriot batteries, but nevertheless, I know going back that the Russians have been they were really deeply rattled. And so not just Putin, but like, the military people, when the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the ABM treaty, and then when the U.S. announced, you know, that it had really moved so forward and so far with anti-ballistic missile systems that it could now achieve first strike superiority, like it could win a first strike war. And the Russians, I don't know how seriously American people take that, you know, and how much of that's marketing, but I can tell you the Russians are extremely paranoid about that.
That was the reason IBM treaty was made in first instance,
right?
Because it's an invitation to other people to think that second strike
doesn't exist, so you have to launch everything.
Capability, you have to launch everything.
We haven't discussed
this today, but I would like to briefly mention this. Remember that in terms of nuclear capabilities, the most dangerous theater is not Ukraine, it's Pakistan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And because Pakistan has no second strike retaliatory capability, because they don't have the World Triad and the nuclear submarine that could be dispersed to strike, but they can still strike Delhi in few minutes, okay, if they decide, few minutes, much shorter time than anything on the U.S. territory that could be hit by the USSR. And this make everybody really paranoid about that in India and in Pakistan, of course, because the point is, if you don't have a survivable second strike capability, either because you don't have it, or because you have the missiles of your opponents very close to your nose, or because you are having anti-ballistic missiles, so you can, or at least you pretend you can shrug off any kind of second strike attack from your opponent. You're just inviting a first strike.
Of course.
Yeah.
I know. It's kind of nuts in that way. I this is slightly off topic, but I'm curious, given your knowledge, what you might know about this. Are those so-called hypersonic missiles, the Kinjal, the Russian ones, I'm saying, and I think the Iskander, did it turn out that they are beatable, or, you know, can you sift the bullshit from the truth and what's going on with that?
Oh, they are all the hypersonic capabilities. They are, in theory, they are there, but there are still enormous challenges in terms of technology. It's it's not anything at the moment that I would consider the main way to go on the short term, because there are technical problems with that. They are huge one.
So they're not very hypersonic. Is this what you mean?
No, they are very hypersonic. Okay. But the point is, they are creating, there is trouble in terms of the re-entry, the controllability, the way they can be controlled, and the way how they can be deployed. There is a whole technical element to it that makes a lot of people that is more knowledgeable than me very, very skeptical about the idea that right now you have a deployable hypersonic capability. Mm. The real problem is not hypersonic stuff, is they are drones.
Yes.
They are low speed stuff. The idea that you can use low altitude controllable drones that are very easy to detect. There is something that probably you don't know, but around, I think in the 60s, at some point, there was a plan from the Soviet Union. But most of the, as you probably, you may know, most of the trajectories for a ICBM launch from the Russian continent to the US or vice versa is over the North Pole. Okay, because the shorter trajectory, mm-hmm. the most direct shorter trajectory is over the North Pole, because the Earth is round, and mm-hmm. and so there is less space to, and particularly the point is you're going to launch above the atmosphere, because the point is the ICBM is going to go in space and then re-enter the bus that is holding all those multiple warheads. Birds. Is going to re-enter, and that can be steered, by the way. We re-enter mm-hmm. and then release the words in a ballistic way. At some point, the Soviet decided they wanted to go the other way around. Use low altitude, low speed. They were drones, actually. They were not called drones, but they were drones that could be used, delivered by satellites over the South Pole, going the other way around. Wow. The much longer way, going south and going up toward, and then hitting America from the south. Because the point is, the NORAD radar early warning system was overwhelmingly on the Canada border.
Or
inside Canada.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
And at some point, this was somehow discovered or told to the U.S., and the U.S. started to negotiate something. Okay, if you don't do that, we are going to scrap our anti-ballistic system. It was part of the deal that made the anti-ABM treaty possible over a very long time. But the point
and also
is,
I would suppose that any slow and low weapon, once you know about it, loses its power.
Yes, but the thing is, detectability is the key issue here. Because the point is, if you have nuclear, you can protect yourself from nuclear weapon using shielding, any kind of shielding, like digging underground, staying underground, creating shelters or whatever, or destroying or diverting the delivery system. And with the technology you had 50 years ago, it was much easier the former than the later. Now, with the kind of precision that we have, and particularly the kind of space system that we have to see everything that happens inside our atmosphere from every angle, the temptation is that to try to use overwhelmingly system that could detect anything wrong that is happening and destroying it. But this simply invites the opponent to miniaturize, to hide stuff, to make everything even more low altitude, slow motion, and everything. And
yeah, well, again, and in that context, I'm still pushing for the fishing boat, you know, trawler.
Exactly.
That makes about 5 knots an hour.
Exactly. You put it inside. I mean, you put it inside any American or Japanese or European port, and you say, if you don't do what I want, this is going to be to explode in 8 hours, and then let's see. Let's enjoy the panic. The people running away desperately from any port anywhere in Europe, US, or Japan, because they think that they may die.
So I think just to kind of wrap up a little bit, I mean, it sounds to me like, although it's stupid to assume, to get blasé, as people have become very blasé about nukes now, just basically on the theory that it hasn't happened yet, therefore it won't happen. Nevertheless, that said, it really doesn't sound like it would make a lot of sense, a lot of military, any sense for Putin to order nukes to be used, unless NATO came into the game, or somehow, you know, miraculously, like Ukraine was marching right onto to Moscow.
Okay, I will leave you with something that may be even less happy than the idea of the trawler in some Japanese port filled with nukes. As I said, I began this episode saying nukes are political weapons. They're not military. They use it as a political tool of exchange because the mere fear they create is the most powerful weapon that you have. But at some point, and this is probably the most single important thing I'm going to say tonight, at some point, you must make sure your threat is credible. Any threat.
Exactly. That's what
credible.
I've been wondering. Like, now that people are starting to think there's no credible threat, that's its own danger now, right? In a sense.
Yes. Yeah. Because the point is, it invites, we have been going on for decades with MAD, mutually assured destruction, basically. We don't do it because it will be pointless. The point is, I think, I seriously think, I hope I'm wrong, we're going to go back very soon into brinkmanship. The kind of, and brinkmanship can be very effective, but it's very dangerous. The idea that I'm going to act a bit more crazy, like
more Nixon
did that, or tried to do that. It was not very good about it, but Nixon tried to do that. But the point is, you don't even have to be Nixon. But the point is, I'm sure. I know, never make any prediction about this idea, that we may enter again an age of brinkmanship, because on one side we have someone like Putin who is not in the most stable possible position ever. But remember, the US leadership right now is even less in a stable position, because we all know they are desperate to try to recreate an idea of an all-powerful, all-winning,
yeah, they're desperate for the 20th century. And,
yes.
And in that,
exactly.
And in that context, the other thing that might lead to nukes that is hard to calculate is hate. They have a lot of hate.
Yeah.
And their own situation domestically is unacceptable, unthinkable to them. I mean, the fact that they're seen as intruders and unfit custodians of American power is unbearable to them. So they project that at the moment onto Russia, and that is accompanied by a great deal of hate. And that's going to make things very, very unstable.
Yes, I agree.
I would add that the madman theory, I mean, one thing that helped when Nixon tried doing his madman theory stuff and saying, I'm going to blow up the world, is that the Soviet leaders at the time kind of saw the U.S. as crazy, and they definitely weren't. I mean, certainly, like, Khrushchev was, you know, Stalin might have been, but Khrushchev didn't want to blow up the world, and definitely Brezhnev. I mean, I've just finished this German translated biography on Brezhnev, and it's, you know, it's everything you think and worse. He did not want, he's the kind of guy that you would do madman theory on. Nobody's really done a credible madman theory on the U.S., and I'm not sure the U.S. foreign policy elites would back down and be the reasonable ones the way the Soviets were. I don't think they want to lose that game.
Mark, can I contradict you for a moment?
Okay.
There's one person that in recent time did madman theory on the U.S.
And?
Guess who is? Your former president.
You mean Trump? Yes.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Donald Trump did a lot because he did that, and it didn't work in the end.
Yes.
Because, you know, it was not a position. But he tried to do that.
Yeah.
Either you'd give me what I want, or I may or may not create the condition for a coup. And
right.
And of course, I mean, it was half bluster, half who knows what. But the point is, they did that. But they did, it was your president. They did it on your own. I mean, very interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting subject for another episode.
Well, let's wrap it up then. So, I think it's, you know, it's grim and scary, but we're going to keep an eye on it. But, you know, I just wanted to thank you for walking us through, you know, the different kinds of bombs and why. I mean, now I get this idea of, oh, he'll set off a little tactical. That doesn't make much sense, actually. And I haven't heard anybody explain why that's the case. So, but anyway, Anibale, as always, really appreciate it. Thanks for coming on and talking nukes with us.
Thanks to you guys for inviting me.
As always.
Have a nice night.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.